can down the road. It's been kicked from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 22nd day of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It took months for Congress to get around to doing something for this economy. $900 billion, as you know, is where they landed. One of the biggest relief packages ever, yes. But it is a truth universally acknowledged that A, $900 billion is not going to be enough to fix the economic damage being done, and B, a lot of the new help in that bill doesn't last much farther out than early April. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with where the can that has been kicked is going to land, which is to say our short to medium-ish term economic future.
Do not get Kurt Spalding started on government aid. Those one-time $600 stimulus checks?
What is $600 really going to do for an individual at this point? Nothing. As a drop in the bucket for closing our economy down for a half a year or more.
Spalding co-owns Kathmandu's Bar and Grill in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. He is going to apply for the next round of Paycheck Protection Program money, but he says last time was not enough.
We're losing probably well over $100,000 in revenues, well over that. What do you think that does to me, my family, and more importantly, my employees who are sitting out there struggling right now, not paying their bills? Some of them are trying to get food stamps.
But the $900 billion does include a lot. Special access to food stamps extended for 6 months, $300 in extra federal unemployment assistance through March, pandemic unemployment assistance into April, all with a vaccine rolling out.
This is a lot of firepower, and it would not surprise me if this is all that's going to end up being needed.
Michael Strain is with the American Enterprise Institute.
We could have an unemployment rate in the 5 to 6% range by the summer.
But if history is any guide, unemployment rates will still be higher than that among lower income and minority workers. Ashley Harrington is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
There are some businesses that close that may never reopen, right? There are some jobs that are never going to come back. And so it doesn't mean when we do officially get the virus under control that the damage won't still be there.
President-elect Biden has promised more relief once he's in office, but timing where Congress is concerned is unpredictable. Diane Schanzenbach directs the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern and says the most recent delays have been costly.
You know, what we've seen, of course, in the last couple of weeks is increasingly desperate situations, especially for low-income families.
And if that desperation means another stimulus is needed as soon as this one ends, well, human desperation didn't really get Congress to move quickly this last time around. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You know how we say all the time that consumers are the backbone of this economy? Because, you know, they are. With that in mind, here is the macroeconomic quote of the day today. Consumers' assessment of current conditions deteriorated sharply in December as the resurgence of COVID-19 remains a drag on confidence. That was Lynn Franco. She's with a group called the Conference Board. They put out surveys every month of how we are all feeling about things. And the answer really is not good how we're feeling, because Franco went on to say, consumers do not foresee the economy gaining any significant momentum in early 2021. So that. Of course, though, on Wall Street today, some new record highs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The last decade or so has been real good for the American oil and gas industry. Lots of exploration and expanding economy into which to sell all that oil and gas. Could even call it, were you so disposed, a boom time. Thing about boom times, though, is they eventually go bust. And when that happens, the consolidation begins. Mergers and acquisitions of targets of opportunity, of which QEP Resources out in West Texas is today's example. It's being snapped up by Diamondback Energy for about $2.2 billion. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports that the word du jour in the shale-rich Permian Basin right now is contraction.
When oil prices were over $130 a barrel in 2008, investors with little experience in oil and gas tried to get in while it was hot. Michael Lynch is a fellow at the Energy Policy Research Foundation.
You know, the old joke about the doctors and lawyers putting money into it. People really became irrationally exuberant and threw a lot of money at it. People bought into a lot of high-cost production that they shouldn't have done.
He says in the early days of the shale revolution, because the technology was new and innovation was happening every day, many companies developed specific expertise. But Joseph Tripke at Liam LLC, an energy industry research firm, says the sector has matured, the economics have deteriorated, and many companies are over-leveraged.
And so all those things kind of add up where it does make sense for this industry to consolidate. Deleveraging is badly needed, and M&A provides a vehicle to do that.
He says M&A, mergers and acquisitions, just make sense right now. The industry is also preparing for an incoming Biden administration that could be harder on oil and gas than its predecessor. Energy companies are already trying to get more sustainable, but Alex Beaker at Wood Mackenzie says that's often when it makes sense for the bottom line.
I think we're still kind of on the cusp of seeing companies go out of their way to employ technology that is good for the environment, but maybe hurts the bottom line.
He says when that day comes, it could signal a real pivot for the future of energy production in the U.S. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
It occurs to me we've already had two words of the day today on the program, and it's only 7.5 minutes in, but here are three more. Marketplace Morning Report, everything you need to know to start your economic day. China and the United States compete increasingly in this global economy. One of the longstanding rivalries is semiconductors, the computer chips that are the building block of basically everything in tech today. The know-how needed to make those chips is worth billions of dollars, and that introduces the phrase economic espionage into the conversation. In a case that is still going on, the Justice Department has gotten a guilty plea from a Taiwanese company accused of stealing chip secrets to give to their Chinese partners. The assumption by American officials has long been that China uses sophisticated methods and experienced spies in these operations. Not, however, this time, as Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
This story begins with three engineers working for the American semiconductor company Micron. One of them, Kenny Wong, is accused of stealing some 900 of Micron's intellectual property files back in 2016. Semiconductor analyst Jim Handy is floored by this.
First thing I wondered was, how did the guy who stole the IP have the chutzpah to do that?
Handy works for the firm Objective Analysis and also represents Fujian Jinhua, one of the defendant companies in this case, under the Foreign Agent Registration Law. He says Wong took the recipe for making memory chips known as DRAM. They're in our phones, computers, and other consumer devices. Handy says the entire blueprints can fit on a tiny digital card.
A lot of people talk about it as being the size of your thumbnail. And it would be like that if you flattened your thumbnail out, but it sounds painful.
Anyway, court documents say that Wong, DRAM in hand, quit Micron, saying he was joining his family's business. In fact, he went to a competitor. But not before he made two crucial errors. First, Wong stored the stolen goods on his work laptop. And then to hide his digital tracks, he Googled the phrase clear computer data. Again, Jim Handy.
The fact that he downloaded the advice about how to clear off his disk that added to the indications that he was guilty.
But before authorities caught on, Wong took the secrets to a Taiwanese chipmaker called UMC, which is partnering with a Chinese firm, according to UMC's plea. And Wong joined UMC himself. He's an expert in chip making, and that know-how is critical. Anna Puglisi is a fellow at the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown.
The technological knowledge is as important as the actual widgets. That's what we're talking about. It's the art of making something, and that makes it so much more challenging.
So Wong and UMC had what they needed to make chips. Instead, they made their next mistakes. Court documents say UMC managers went recruiting in Silicon Valley, throwing around Micron's proprietary company vocabulary, like internal code names. That was one giveaway. Later in Taiwan, when authorities raided UMC offices, Wang and his collaborators shoved the incriminating evidence into a locker. It got found. Matthew Brazil writes for the publication Spy Talk.
They were just corporate actors acting like corporate people, which is to flush everything down the toilet and hope for the best during a raid.
Brazil is a fellow at the Jamestown Foundation, and he's co-author of the book Chinese Espionage. He says a lot of cases involve these amateur moments.
Packing evidence into their suitcase before they go to China instead of maybe FedEx it, which would have been a lot better.
It's these types of errors that in the end led the U.S. government to indict UMC, plus Kenny Wang, plus the two other engineers and the Chinese partner firm. Here's U.S. Attorney Alex Tse.
These five defendants have been charged with conspiracy to commit theft of trade secrets, economic espionage, and a conspiracy to commit economic espionage.
Specifically, espionage for China, which has declared semiconductor development a top priority. That's partly because China doesn't want to import chips that can also be used for weapons and spying, says Scott Kennedy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
They may simply believe that chips have backdoors or other ways in which the West can maintain their dominance over China.
But the Chinese company in this story, known as Fujian Jinhua, has not succeeded for China. After being indicted and then hit with U.S. sanctions, it hasn't sold a single memory chip, says analyst Jim Handy. The company denies stealing secrets. Still, this is not the only case of its kind, and Kennedy warns there are other attempts we don't know about. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Can we insure nature itself? Who owns it and how do you do it?
How do you do it anyway? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 200 points today, 0.6%, ended at 30,015. The NASDAQ went the other way, up 65, about 0.5%, 12,807. The S&P 500 down 7, about 0.2%, 36.87 there. Apple grew 2.8% today and reports companies moving ahead with plans to make self-driving cars. Tesla also makes self-driving cars and electric cars and all that jazz. Slowed 1.4%. Let's be clear, not completely self-driving, but let's not get wrapped up in that. Speaking of electric cars, by the way, there's a new survey from Consumer Reports shows 71% of people said they had some interest in getting an electric vehicle at some point. Same. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is all kinds of news in mergers and acquisitions today. Euler had energy. Now, working out. Peloton, the interconnected exercise company, bikes mostly, is buying Precor. They make commercial fitness equipment. $420 million is the price tag. This has obviously been a big year for home exercise equipment, and Peloton has been a big winner. Sales have doubled this past year. But as with so many other growth stories, this is actually a supply chain story. And as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, this deal could be the answer to Peloton's problems.
This time last year, if you were talking about Peloton, the conversation probably centered around this ad.
Yes.
Now.
A Peloton? Give it up.
A woman gets a Peloton, props it up next to her living room window, sweats through a bunch of rides, and her life is changed. A year later, with stay-at-home orders, Peloton sales and subscriptions grew and grew, topping a million. And with that growth came supply chain pains. Some customers wound up waiting weeks for bikes. Sridhar Tayor is an operations management professor at Carnegie Mellon. He says Peloton has a plan.
They are buying manufacturing capacity as well as supply chain that goes along with it, manufactured products to the consumers.
Faster, too, because Precor has factories in the U.S. And Tayor says this could work for Precor, too.
They might have built a supply chain expecting a certain demand.
But people aren't exactly crowding into gyms these days. What is crowded? The space Peloton wants to dominate. Echelon Fitness makes cheaper interconnected bikes. Apple just launched a competing fitness platform. And now, lots of gyms and studios offer streaming classes. Americus Reed, a marketing professor at the Wharton School, says Peloton has to think around the next corner.
The way to stay out in front of this is to make sure you're in a position to deliver kind of the next add-on aspect to this.
So the bike screen now swivels. You can hop off and take a yoga class. And with this acquisition, Peloton wants to make sure customers are getting everything they want as soon as they want it. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
There is more PPP money in the relief bill that Congress passed yesterday. Should answer at least one of the questions small business owners are asking themselves. How many of my employees can I keep employed? But there are a whole bunch of other questions they are asking themselves too, those small business owners. Can I do business safely? How long can I stay in business? And for some of them, am I even in the right business? Marketplace's Justin Ho has this story of a small business owner in South Carolina who changed up his company and wound up thriving.
When the pandemic started, Sherrar Duvall realized that his video production company, OTR Media Group, was going to have a hard time producing short films and feature-length documentaries.
You know, we got associate producers, we got camera guys, we got audio guys, we got lighting guys, script guys, you know. It's very hard to do that distance.
All of the work the company did fell off a cliff.
You know, in June, I was sweating bullets.
Duvall tried to keep his business alive. He applied for a Paycheck Protection Program loan in March, but like a lot of minority business owners, he kept hitting dead ends. When I talked to him in June, Duvall said he had submitted 7 applications without any luck.
It's been a 3-month slog and struggle, and it's frustrating is probably the best word to describe it. Upsetting, really.
So Duvall turned to nonprofit groups for advice, and the answer he kept getting was to pivot.
They were always saying pivot, pivot, pivot. And I was like, you know, what? You know, to be honest with you, Justin, it was pissing me off at one point.
Because he had no idea what the company was supposed to pivot to.
When you're talking about someone like us, who's a service-based business that has a specific model, particularly based around media, you're already doing all the things that you're good at.
But then the light bulb went off, and he realized the pandemic had created demand for video work the company hadn't been doing. Building and installing live streaming equipment.
You know, we did end up pivoting, and that pivot really saved us.
OTR Media landed gigs with a church and a synagogue. It started helping teachers set up home studios and producing videos for universities to use in online lectures.
It saved our business. There's no doubt about it. You know, I was joking with my accountant, and I was like, had it not been for that, I really don't know what I would do.
Business had already started to improve by the time Duvall finally got a PPP loan in July. He says he spent it within days, paying staff and settling utility bills that were long overdue.
Which freed up our ability to go, okay, now that we're making more money, now that some of that debt is gone, let's look at recalibrating selling and advertising. Let's look into doing the website.
Duvall says all of the company's business has started to bounce back. The company's more robust now, but getting there was not pleasant.
When you're not sure how you're going to pay anybody and you're 3 months behind on bills, you know, I don't see how you see that as a positive at all, you know.
Even though Washington has authorized more Paycheck Protection Program money, Duvall says he probably won't apply. He doesn't feel like going through that process all over again. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
. 2020, unprecedented in so very many ways, also set hurricane records. It was only the second time that Greek alphabet letters were used to name storms, because we used up the Roman alphabet. Another new thing in this hurricane season, what is said to be the first insurance payout for damage to a natural resource, a coral reef down in Mexico hit by Hurricane Delta. It's a new kind of policy meant to help mitigate an ever-growing problem. Kathy Boffman-McLeod helped develop it. She is at the Atlantic Council. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell me, would you, where this idea for insuring the coral reefs, where that came from?
I have been working in conservation and in risk and risk management, and we began to think, okay, you need a product. You need to show the value of how nature protects people and economies. And so started thinking about what would we insure, and can we insure nature itself? Who owns it, and how do you do it?
Yeah. So there's a coral reef off Quintana Roo down in Mexico near Cancun, which was the subject of the story in the Times that I read, and obviously the insurance policies that you all came up with. Mm-hmm. Does the municipality of Cancun or the state of Quintana Roo just call Lloyd's of London and say, hey, I want to insure my coral reef? How does it work?
No. And, you know, I should say it's more fun than that, than all of the...
Oh, gosh. Insurance? More fun than that? How surprising.
Yes. And yes, people, their eyes roll back and you lose people in a second when you say insurance. And yeah. So it's super exciting. It really is. And, you know, with $32 trillion in assets under management, the insurance industry, they change markets. And they are invested in reducing the risks that they face, you know, financially, but also, you know, both financial and physical risk. But the key thing is that we were trying to insure something that no one owns. Mm-hmm. And so how do you build the conversation so that you focus on the beneficiaries?
So this coral reef gets damaged. The insurance policy covers the damage to the reef because the insurance company didn't want to pay for the damage to the beach that would have resulted if the coral reef hadn't been there. Is that sort of nuts and bolts?
Yeah, yes, mostly. So okay. The coral reef and the beach go together. A healthy reef is acting as a natural seawall. When you think about the tourism industry, so that in Quintana Roo, that tourism industry is $10 billion a year, and the hotels and the restaurants and things on the beach are being protected by that reef. And so the money pays to keep the reef in health so it can continue to provide that ecosystem service to protect the economy on the shore.
So if I'm an insurance company and I know that the climate is changing and that coral reefs are in danger or sequoias in California are at wildfire risk, or take your pick of natural catastrophe, all of which we have seen multiplying in the past number of years as climate change gets more serious. If I'm an insurance company, why do I want to get near one of these things? Because it's almost guaranteed to be a lose-lose deal at some point.
Well, the insurance contracts are a year at a time. Mm. And so the insurance industry has a chance to assess every year, where do they want to place their risk around the world? That's one. And two, they're also increasingly understanding how powerful these natural systems are to reduce the risks. And so you'll see companies, you know, brokers, primary insurers, and reinsurers involved in better understanding how to create these kinds of products. But you're right. You know, all of this is about climate adaptation. But until we get our act together on emissions, we have to be doing these types of approaches.
This is your line of work. Are you getting traction with this argument?
Absolutely. You know, one of the biggest brokerage firms in the world, Willis Towers Watson, launched an ecosystem, a global ecosystem resilience facility, the GERF, unfortunately. Well, unfortunate acronym, but a cool thing. And so you see the business getting into it pretty clearly. And so we'll keep going while we get our act together on mitigation.
Kathy Boffman-McLeod, she is the director of the Adrian Arsh Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center at the Atlantic Council. Kathy, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which what you might have thought would happen didn't. Saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. Remember back at the beginning of this thing, there were all those stories about how Corona beer was basically done for? I mean, who's going to drink a beer that shares a name with a deadly virus, right? Turns out about as many people who were drinking it before. A Chicago-based market research firm called IRI says in-store sales of Corona beer, and I am using the word beer here loosely in conjunction with Corona, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, in-store sales of Corona this year, basically the same as last year. All right, we got to go, but here is your Tuesday moment of economic context. A hiccup, perhaps, in the heretofore hot housing market in which prices are high and supply of homes for sale is low, very low. The National Association of Realtors said this morning that sales of existing homes fell in November for the first time in 6 months. Here's a little tidbit on that supply-demand thing, by the way. The supply of homes on the market at the end of November was the lowest it's been on records going back to 1982. So, low. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Ben Hethcote, Eliza Mills, and Janet Wynn. Star Neves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.